This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad, and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 4, Episode 17 of Commentary Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are going to be recapping our look at J.J. Abrams' work as a feature film director. He made 4 movies so far, with the 5th one on the way. And we'll just go through movie by movie and give our thoughts.
His next movie is Super 9, right?
That's exactly what it is.
That's what I thought it was.
Yes.
That's what I thought it was.
So his first movie came in 2006, and that was Mission Impossible 3.
Yes, his first directed movie, yeah.
Yeah. So what were your thoughts on Mission Impossible 3?
I thought it was a fairly forgettable action movie. Like a lot of things, that I wouldn't be talking about it had it not been for people continually talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't complain about forgettable action movies from 6 years ago on a regular basis.
8.
Because nobody talks about them anymore.
Yeah.
That one keeps coming up because you keep talking about it. And because J.J. Abrams keeps doing things despite not really ever blowing me away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this was the first time, movie-wise, that he had blown me away. I was very impressed by Mission Impossible 3. I said it was the best movie of 2006, and I maintain that. I think that it's extremely well done as far as an action movie is concerned. Nothing like revolutionary, but there's sort of this like workmanlike precision and craft, you know, associated with this movie, which reminded me a lot of movies from like the 80s and stuff and 90s that you know, I kind of grew up with, like Spielberg and McTiernan sort of things, you know, where it was just like, this is how you tell a story in an action setting, you know. I was very impressed by this movie, needless to say. And it's, in a lot of ways, I think, superior to even my favorite of his movies, which is Star Trek from 2009.
Yeah.
This was his follow-up. You know, we talked a little bit about how, you know, both of them were produced by Paramount, and Paramount was very happy with the way that Mission Impossible 3 turned out. So they handed over the Star Trek franchise to Abrams, and this was his second film. It rebooted the franchise, obviously, in sort of a clever fashion.
That's a word you use.
And what are your thoughts on Star Trek 09?
It's a fairly forgettable action movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it might count as Star Trek, but it's not anywhere close to what Star Trek does best. And it's actually, I find it actually rather sad that Star Trek is in a position now that the best it can do is a fairly forgettable action movie.
See, I don't think that that's the best that Star Trek can do.
The best that it can do now.
Right, I know what you're saying. And I don't think that that is the best that it can do now. I think that, you know, what it's doing now is making action movies, but I mean, the best that it could do before, let's say in the Next Gen era, the best that it could do was what? Let's just say All Good Things, right? Okay, just as an example. And yet that didn't stop them from making Nemesis and Insurrection, you know? That wasn't the best that they could do at the time. That's just what they did at the time. So, like, I don't see any reason why, even if you didn't like Star Trek 09, which I did like, I don't see any reason why it can't do better while still being a big summer blockbuster action movie.
I don't think you're aware that what I'm saying is not that they can't do it. I'm saying that they're not going to because they don't need to. If the bar that has to be cleared is people will come to see it and buy tickets, and it will not be torn to shreds by the critical community, then that's the bar that they'll clear. And they're not going to shoot higher than that. And that's just because that's just the way the world works. If you can do something successfully, you're not going to change it just because you want to do better. Especially not with a franchise that is basically an intellectual property. It's an IP that has a dollar value attached to it. And as long as that dollar value is the most important thing, it will not be challenging. And that's just because that's the way the world works. And it's definitely the way the studio system works. And it is, without question, the way J.J. Abrams works.
Okay, well, I don't agree with that's how J.J. Abrams works. I don't agree with it being not challenging. And while I do agree that what you're saying applies to the studio, and it applies not just to Star Trek, but every other intellectual property in existence,
mm-hmm.
I also think that the people making this movie do not adhere to those low standards. You know, the people making the movie genuinely want to make something great. And, you know, especially, you know, where you got like Roberto Orci in there, who's a huge Star Trek fan himself.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he wants to make the best Star Trek he can.
I think it's entirely possible that a lot of people want to do something great. And I think that it's bizarrely naive to assume that just because people want to, that it will eventually get there. Because the reality is that these are not movies made by 1, 2, or even 100 people. It's made by many, many people over many years. And no matter what any individual wants to do, it's not going to be something other than what it must be.
But it can be something more than what it must be.
Yes.
This is something which we've seen happen time and again. I mean, The Dark Knight.
Yes.
Is something more than what it must be.
Yes, it is. And it's largely because it didn't have the burden that Star Trek had at the time. And Star Trek is a complicated property. The part of the problem is that the fans are very weird about the continuity and about the world and about the franchise. And I think a really serious problem exists when the fans' response to Star Trek 2009 is, you know, it wasn't wrong. It wasn't incorrect. It didn't make the errors that people were afraid of. It was faithful to the continuity, and it didn't break anything that came before it. That's really a sad state of affairs when that's considered to be successful.
Okay, I don't know which fans you're talking to, but I mean, I think the general thought amongst the fans these days is that Star Trek 9 was okay. It was fun in the same way that something like First Contact was fun, but that it wasn't great Trek, and that Star Trek Into Darkness was a bad movie. That's what I see happening amongst most hardcore fans. Obviously, there are exceptions. I'm an
sure.
exception.
I'm not talking about the idea of like what they thought of it. I'm saying that at the point Star Trek was before 2009, Star Trek was sort of it had receded, as just franchise tend to do. It had become sort of dominated by its history, and it like basically had the sort of the Marvel Comics sort of environment where its history was its strength and also its burden, mm-hmm. and it like the fans that had existed. We're not going away, but because it's just the way it works, the franchise has to add new fans in order for it to survive. So in order to bring in new fans, the rejuvenation was required. And that's just It's happened to Star Trek before. It happened in 1979. It's a thing. You have to occasionally reinvent the thing in order to bring new people in. And this reinvention was an opportunity to do some very serious things about Star Trek and to handle some issues that had come up in the past 30 years or so. And instead of being honest about it and purging the problems and reaffirming its qualities, it actually kind of edged around all of those issues by not really challenging the problems of Star Trek and not embracing its strengths, essentially by dodging Star Trek's biggest problems and biggest resources.
Okay, I don't agree that it dodged those things. I think that maybe it could have utilized them a bit better. But I also think that in terms of addressing its greatest weaknesses, I think it totally did that. And I think that it improved its greatest weakness by leaps and bounds.
And I disagree on what that weakness is.
Well, I'm sure
because,
you do.
Because, I mean, your argument is that its greatest weakness was essentially its modernity. It's it being in some way stodgy.
Yeah, its formal quality.
And while that might definitely be a quantifiable problem from a financial stance,
it's not just that. It's totally not just that. It's that in the sense of, like, in the mid-90s, you know, I'm sitting there watching Star Trek, having been a huge fan of Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and feeling an obligation more than anything to continue to watch this show, and then flipping the channel to, say, something like The Sopranos and being like, why am I even bothering watching Star Trek? Because it's not even trying to be relevant. You know what I mean? It's not even trying to keep up with the latest innovations and the latest improvements that have been made to television. And I think that you would agree that television made huge strides in the 90s and aughts and became, you know, in many ways superior to film.
Sure, but I would also make a very serious, significant criticism of that problem by saying that if, in order to ascend to a modern, formal environment, you have to throw away the qualities that made this thing good despite that formal stodginess. And that is what we're talking about here. Like, that is what is going on. Star Trek was a show that was critical and was in a lot of ways rebellious. And it was not afraid to alienate people who were not willing to go along.
Yeah, see, here's the difference. And this is something which, you know, I brought up on that commentary and in which, you know, I've sort of been fighting against, you know, every step of the way, which is like, it's not an either-or thing. Yes, it did have some problems that you're talking about, okay? It did.
What's not an either-or thing?
Well, like, what you're saying is that in order to achieve those formal qualities, it had to throw out these other things.
Oh, well, I'm not saying that it had to. It did.
Okay, but I'm not saying... I'm saying that it didn't do that in order to achieve that. I'm saying that both of those things happened, and they were independent of each other.
I would say that that's entirely possible. And I don't feel the need to argue which came first or which was the progenitor of the following thing. What I'm saying is that when you are working in a franchise that has qualities, if you are trying to repair or transcend some particular quality problem, that's a perfectly fine thing to do, and it's perfectly acceptable to throw out things that are problematic in order to get there. But in that process, if you also, parallel to that, throw out a quality of this thing in order to do anything else, even if they're completely unrelated, the worst thing to do is take out that thing's uniqueness.
Okay. Now, I would disagree that it takes out that thing's uniqueness. I think that I really, really do think that people are comparing essentially one, now two movies to 724 things that came before it, or however many there were exactly. I mean,
I'm not lumping myself in here with other people who criticize these movies for whatever reason, because okay, I would conclude that it also fits for First Contact,
yeah, Nemesis,
and that's what I was going to say. Generations.
That's what I was going to say here. Okay, let's do this. Ignore everything about the movie except for the script. Okay, that's the only thing we're talking about right now.
Sure.
Okay. Do you think that, okay, and I know some of these are going to be obvious, okay, but I'm just going to go through the franchise. Do you think that Star Trek 09 is better written than the motion picture?
No.
Wrath of Khan?
Oh, God, no.
I know. Like I said, I'm just going through.
Okay.
Search for Spock?
Yes.
Voyage Home?
How about even?
Final Frontier?
No.
Interesting. Undiscovered Country?
No.
Generations?
No.
First Contact?
Yeah. It's, that's about the same.
Insurrection?
About the same.
And Nemesis?
Very slightly better.
Okay. So, I mean, what we're seeing here is just, I mean, there's a larger sample, and obviously there's some huge, you know, outliers, like the Nicholas Meyer movies, which mm-hmm. I would agree are better written than Star Trek 09.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I know that you'd probably say that those other movies were poorly written. I would disagree. I mean, to me, I think that Star Trek...
other movies are poorly written?
Like... Search for Spock, you know, and First Contact and Insurrection.
Poorly written is a very vague term. I think it's more complicated than that.
Okay. But, you know, I do enjoy all of those movies. I mean, but I think that, you know, some of those movies are extremely well written, and yet I also think that Star Trek 09 is written better than those movies.
I think that there's a unidirectional like quality to this, which is like the criticism of a thing on one level, and I think it's more complicated than that. Because while there's from an engineering point of view, the engineering of a script, the engineering of a story, that complexity varies greatly. But there are instances where the engineering of the story might be rather complicated and rather nuanced, and you must conclude that the people who are responsible for it are quite clever, but the engineering that they have done is the production of something that is destructive. And no matter how difficult or complicated or nuanced the script of Star Trek III is, it is ultimately a weapon.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with that analysis completely. You know, I think that that's, you know, overstating what it is, and I think it is a force for good. And whether or not Star Trek 09 is the best written of the movies, what Star Trek 09 as a movie on the whole did, inclusive of everything, you know, not just the script, is it act as like a stepping stone to get Star Trek, the franchise, into the modern era. And I think that even if Star Trek 09 is quote-unquote bad, I see that as the equivalent of, like, sacrificing a pawn in order to save your king, you know? And the king will be saved when we get a new Star Trek series, which is written by, you know, someone who's really, really, really good and can tell the stories that they've been telling for the past 50 years, but can do it with a formal style which is worthy of the 21st century.
And I like that you used the king analogy, because I would absolutely agree that's exactly what's going on. A pawn has been sacrificed in order to preserve a royal line.
And
there is a point when you kill the royal line.
Okay.
You end it. in order to create a better government. Yes. And what we have is a royal line that has become very complacent, and they do nothing except absorb taxes.
Well, that, I would say, has been true. Well, okay, if I were to agree with that, based on your analysis, I would have to say that that has been going on since 1999.
I would agree.
Yeah.
And I think that saying that any attempt to keep this thing going now doesn't, it doesn't temper anything that the attempt is valiant. No matter how noble the knight is who fights for this king, he's fighting for a corrupt king.
Maybe they're not trying to be valiant. Maybe the next people who come in will try to be defiant.
Yes. And we're not going to get that.
Okay.
We're not going to get that because that's just not the way it works.
Okay. But I would also say that you saying that Star Trek 09 is the moment when Star Trek became a weapon and the moment when
No, that's where there was an opportunity. A very significant and serious opportunity to do some very significant positive changes.
Okay.
And instead of that, that opportunity was squandered.
Okay. Because I would say that it became a weapon if I agreed with your analysis of this stuff. You know, if I agreed with what you were saying here, I would say that it became that weapon way earlier than 2009. Probably, I would say, when they used it to launch a new network, you know?
There are plenty of opportunities where this occurred. That's absolutely true. But like any system, when, like let's just use a royal line analogy. The kingdom was in disrepair. It was in collapse. And the people stood around and waited for somebody to take charge.
Yeah.
And they should have taken control.
I wasn't trying to go with the royal analogy. I was trying to make a chess analogy, obviously.
Yes, but you know. I've made this argument many times that what we are talking about is a thing that has outlived its usefulness. And when you outlive your usefulness, I mean, like the argument that history makes is that that's when you kill the king.
Mm-hmm.
When the empire is no longer beneficial to the people, when the king is no longer actually helping the community and he just becomes a sponge, well, that's actually the result of previous kings doing a good job. If the kings are doing a good job, eventually they will have to be killed or step down.
Perhaps.
That's just the way it works. If the culture evolves to the point where it no longer needs it, then that's where it ends. And I think Star Trek reached that point around 1992.
That could be, but if you look at the stuff
it should have departed.
But if you look at the stuff that we've gotten after 1992, I'm willing to take the bad in order to get the good.
And I think that the problem is that we're getting less good. The good is diminishing. And we long ago hit peak good.
Perhaps, but
we are now getting little scraps of good because that take a lot more bad in order to get.
Perhaps, but I would also say that we're on an upswing. Would you not say, and I guess this is something which I've never asked you, would you not say that the Abrams movies are better than Voyager and Enterprise?
I would say better than some Voyager, obviously Enterprise.
Right. And so I think that the pendulum is swinging in the other direction. How many analogies can we use in this particular?
I can work six more in. Okay. But the thing is that what I'm talking about here is that this is like a legitimate philosophical concept, and I want to just make this very clear. No matter how much energy you put into this, you're not going to get it to go higher than it went before.
I don't know.
This pendulum might swing upwards and downwards forever.
It happened. It happened with Batman.
Energy.
It happened with Batman. Are you telling me that the pendulum didn't stop swinging with Batman and Robin?
Oh, no, it absolutely did. And the opportunity to throw out everything wrong with it and embrace everything good about it was taken.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing to lose.
Right.
But when there is nothing to lose, there is an opportunity to do something great. And that is not what has happened. Because for whatever reason, the desire to maintain the existing fan base was considered important. And the existing fan base was largely placated by essentially not being alienated. And the non-existing fan base, the new fans, were created by not being alienating. And there is a thing present in any form of media, when you must bring in new people, it's hard to argue that you need to do something that might alienate people.
Well, perhaps.
And alienation is absolutely crucial for anything art. If you're making a work of art and everyone agrees with you, then you're not making art.
Okay, but see, here's the thing, too. And we'll get into this in a second as well with Into Darkness. But is it possible that with Star Trek 09, what you're doing is you're bringing in that new audience, and that's the spoonful of sugar that you're giving them. And then starting with Into Darkness and, you know, kind of moving forward, perhaps we are going to get into the alienation and the tough lessons that Star Trek has to teach its new audience. You know,
if you
bring them in with something fun and cool, and then once they're here and once they're hooked, then you give them the medicine.
That would be lovely. That's not what's happening.
Well, we shall see.
The reason it's not what's happening is because Star Trek is not. It just doesn't work that way. Well, the franchise essentially has become too big in order to do anything radical. And that's what Star Trek was so good about. That's what its main strength was. And when it was created, it was a show that said things that people were upset about. It did things that people were angry about. It made enemies. And in order to make change, you have to make enemies. And we have gone from a Star Trek that was part of a transformation of a culture to a Star Trek that is rather entertaining to some people.
Well, I think that we have
lost
this
incredible thing that Star Trek was. And you know what would get us that again? Radical political statements that people would be upset about.
Well, I mean, with Roberto Orci at the helm, maybe.
I would absolutely love it if Roberto Orci legitimately had all the power that a person in his office is supposed to have.
Yeah.
But that's just not the way the studio system works. No matter how much power he might have over this movie will not be. It will not have the freedom to alienate its audience.
So then maybe, like I was saying before, the thing to happen, the best thing that can happen, and I do enjoy these movies quite a bit, and I think that they do offer a lot beyond entertainment, but maybe the best thing that can happen is Roberto Orci making the movie or the franchise popular enough to get it back on the air and get it into a little corner of the media landscape where it can start being subversive in doing that kind of under the radar where, you know, the heads of studios aren't going to be scrutinizing every last detail.
They're making an argument that it's possible to do that, and I really don't think that it's possible to do that because, I mean, there is definitely a legitimate, difficult to quantify, but undeniable reality that there are factors in the creation of a thing that cannot be precisely measured, but there are absolutely arcs and patterns and structures that are bolstered and weakened and evolve, and Star Trek has evolved in a particular direction for a very long time without really anybody ever sitting down and deciding what those things were. It went in a direction. And the direction that it went in was very specific, and there was a point when the resources of that particular property were largely expended. And at that point, it had to change in order to survive. And the change that it made to survive was to purge the elements that made it possible to be revolutionary. And Star Trek, no matter what a crazy person with a crazy possessed typewriter and a bunch of really crazy people who were willing to go along with his crazy plan to do whatever, no matter what, it is very hard to imagine a scenario in which it is possible to turn this thing into the radically challenging science fiction tale that it once was.
Okay. I mean, just to sort of wrap up this movie, you know, and I'll just say that I understand what it is you're saying. I don't think that that's happening. But even if it were happening, I don't see why it would be so hard to get it back to what it was. If they were able to do it in 1994, they could do it now. Because, I mean, just looking at the television programming which is out there now, I see a lot more of that kind of thing going on than I did back in the 90s.
Look at the economy. Look at the fragmentation of media outlets. Look at the bizarre unification of other media outlets from history. There are now millions of media outlets, and huge chunks of them are owned by very small groups of people, and they are run by very small, even smaller groups of people. And the resources required in order to do a science fiction show that is as challenging as Star Trek was do not exist.
Yeah, I disagree.
In Star Trek.
I disagree.
In order for Star Trek to get there again,
I think that we can find parallels.
In order for it to get to that point, it would need to fail hard.
I think it already did that.
I'm not seeing it. I'm not seeing it failing hard. I'm talking about a massive box office failure. I'm talking about people not seeing Into Darkness. I'm talking about like legitimately huge losses of money.
I think that television is a different beast. And I think if you have an audience there, they don't really care what you do. I think that we're seeing that.
That's not the world. That's not the world.
Well, I think we see that a lot with you know, what's on TV now.
But that's not the world. Like, what's on TV now is still struggling with the same problem that Star Trek has. It's always been a problem. Like, the idea that a thing can't be revolutionary because it alienates the audience, which means it's not going to make the money back, it's a constant problem in everything. And the best thing about Star Trek was that it survived despite that.
I mean, what do you think Battlestar Galactica did?
It dodged the problem.
I don't see that happening, but whatever. Okay, so let's take a break from Star Trek for just a moment and talk about J.J. Abrams' third movie, which came in 2011, and that was Super 8.
It's fun to say 3.
Okay. What were your thoughts on Super 8?
I think it's the most solid movie that J.J. Abrams has made. It's not particularly significant.
Okay. I think it's the least solid movie that he's made, but I still think that it is a decent film. I do like the stylistic choices in order to sort of grasp that essence of 70s and 80s Spielberg, and also grasp the essence of that era.
It's definitely 80s Spielberg.
Yeah,
he didn't get into the suburbs until later.
I do think, though, that movie's strengths involve the characters and the personal stories, and the sci-fi elements are actually kind of weak and distracting from what's really going on.
I would say that's true of all of J.J. Abrams' things. His science fiction is kind of weak. Like, he uses science fiction a lot, and he doesn't really have the... I don't think he has the imagination to come up with something really interesting.
I think that he can do sci-fi well, but I think that he does drama, character stuff better, personal drama better.
I think that's a problem. I mean, when your science fiction franchise requires that the characters be the main thing and the science fiction is no longer particularly important, then...
Well,
Why are there spaceships?
I'm not saying that it's not important. I'm just saying that it might not be as good sometimes as it should be. But, I mean, I would love to see him do a non-sci-fi, just small little movie, kind of like Jon Favreau just did with Chef. You know, I think that would be cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we've had that little reprieve, let's go back to Star Trek for J.J. Abrams' final movie to date, which was last year's Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yep.
And what are your thoughts on that?
To a great extent, it's got all the same problems as the first one. It's lots of flashy, very little thing to be deserving of flashiness.
Okay. I mean, again, I disagree. While I don't think that it's as good as the original, I do think that it is extremely good. I also think that it does a good job of sort of dealing with social issues from, you know, current events and things that we're dealing with. And I appreciate that they tried to do that with this one, where they didn't try to do it so much with the last one. And I think that it does give you something, you know, interesting to think about. And the Khan thing, I mean, I don't have a problem at all with them using Khan. I do think that there were a few missteps in regards to how they handled him and how much of it, you know, paralleled what was going on in Wrath of Khan and all that stuff. And there are a few moments in there where it's like, you've gone a bit too far. I see what you're trying to do. You've gone a bit too far. But on the whole, I mean, aside from those few little minor moments, I don't think that you can fault the overall story for that. It still works pretty well for me. And I do think that, you know, while not nearly as good as Star Trek 09, it is a very solid movie.
You've mentioned this on a couple occasions, but like the idea that that movie is, that has, the movie has a political commentary, it doesn't.
It definitely does. It really doesn't. I mean, it's certainly more so than most Star Trek.
No. Yeah. No.
Oh, yeah.
No.
For sure.
No. Not even close.
Okay.
That's absurd. Look, the political element in Into Darkness is like friggin'... I'm trying to think of an example that is ridiculously simple.
Where's the political commentary in Star Trek Nemesis?
Oh, I would agree that there's definitely places where it's worse.
Where it's worse. Where Nemesis is worse. Okay.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Yeah, about the same. The problem is that there's not much there. And I'm not saying that it's absent. I'm saying that if you're going to say that it's got this going on, it's very, very, very weak.
Well, the movie has a lot of other things going on in it. It's not like it's you know, relying on the political commentary,
right? But because
the main thrust of the movie is sort of about the relationship between Kirk and Spock, and right. There's a lot to be taken from that.
So, if you hypothetically disagree with the political point of view of the movie, does that affect your ability to enjoy it?
I would imagine it would, yeah.
I have not seen this. I have seen people who have not even noticed the political commentary, the really subtle little political commentary that basically maybe kind of relates to, like, American geopolitics in foreign countries. Maybe, like, a little bit, like a hair of that.
I think
people who disagree don't notice it because that's how weak it is.
Okay, well, I think that maybe those people aren't paying attention, but I think that's kind of a standard thing that happens. I think that's why a movie like Star Trek is able to, you know, get through the cracks like that. I mean, that's the whole point of it. That's what they said they did on the original series, was they were like, we want to deal with these issues that they won't let us deal with in primetime TV.
So you code them.
So you code them. You put it in space, and then it is.
And what you end up with is a thing that changes things if it's actually there. And the problem with the commentary that you're talking about in Into Darkness is that if you remove it, nothing changes.
I don't see how that's true. But whatever. I mean, I don't see how you have a villain in the movie if you remove it. You know? I don't see how you have an arc for your main character if you remove it.
What do you mean? How do you... There's no arc for your main character.
You don't think so?
There's absolutely no arc for your main character.
Okay. Well, that I see as being ridiculous and sort of a misreading of what's going on in the movie.
Oh,
but
God.
Whatever. I mean, I can totally see that for Kirk. Okay. I mean, we can break it down right now if you want.
No, because we've been through this, and the main thing that we've done over and over again whenever we do this is that you break down, like, this character arc, and I say that's really the complexity of, like, a comic strip.
Okay, well, I disagree with that, and regardless, even if it is the complexity of a comic strip, which it's not.
Four panels of complexity.
It's still there. You're saying that it's not there. It is there.
Okay.
Okay? And it does, it is relevant, and it is worthy of discussion.
But I think it's depressing when that is considered sufficient. I don't give movies thumbs up because they tick the necessary boxes.
But there's a lot more, like I said, there's a lot more going on in it than just that, you know? There's a lot of little things going on in that movie, which when you put them all together equals one really cool big thing. So
yeah, I've heard you quantify it before, and what I hear is a whole bunch of really tiny insignificant boxes.
All right. So moving on to J.J. Abrams's future projects. He's got a movie which he's working on right now. It's called Star Wars Episode 7. He's co-writing it with Lawrence Kasdan, the guy who wrote The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And it is going to be coming out about a year from now, December of 2015. So what are your hopes and dreams or fears or whatever for Star Wars?
I have none of those things.
Episode 7.
I have none of those things.
Okay.
I don't have any hopes. I don't have any fears. I don't have any concerns. I have no feelings about this. This is another franchise that has outlived its usefulness. Honestly, I think that it's even more depressing with Star Wars because Star Wars basically informs the audience in the first two movies that there will be a point where you will have to discard this franchise. And the idea that after all this time it's still going clearly to me indicates that the fans weren't paying attention.
Okay, yeah. I think that while I do enjoy all of the Star Wars movies that have come before, I see what's happening with J.J. Abrams and the rest of the people who are now making Star Wars as sort of a renaissance in that franchise. I see them realizing what it was that made the original movie so great and sort of embracing those qualities and making something...
Part of that is not embracing those qualities.
That could be. And making something which is going to stand up to those other movies. And I think it's really kind of interesting how, I mean, I guess it is similar to what he did with Star Trek in that he's going back to the original source material and bringing in, you know, the original characters and everything like that. But unlike that, I think, you know, stylistically and in terms of, like, filmmaking, what we're seeing here is the opposite of what he did with Star Trek. Whereas with Star Trek, he was like, I need to revamp stylistically what's going on in this franchise and make it something new. Whereas in this one, he's like, it got revamped into something weird. Now I need to strip all that out of it and bring that back to basics too and make this more like what the original was, since the original was damn near perfect. So
yeah,
that in addition to the fact that, I mean, I will go see anything that J.J. Abrams does because to me his track record is stellar. And I cannot wait for Star Wars Episode 7 as well as the other Star Wars movies, but Star Wars Episode 7 in particular because I have so much faith in the people involved, including J.J. So there's that.
Star Wars is basically about revolution. And now there is absolutely no way to be revolutionary in it. No matter what you do, you can't change it. Like, you seem to be on the impression that these people can actually do something good in this system. The system makes it impossible.
Okay. Well, I think that you will be proven wrong on December 18th, 2015, or whatever it is.
Sure.
Okay, so any final thoughts on J.J. Abrams' career as a filmmaker?
I think, like a lot of people who are not satisfied with the Star Trek reboot, I would agree with many of the words used. But I think that the reality that what we have is not particularly impressive is a much bigger problem than one guy. I don't think that J.J. Abrams is at fault for these movies being banal. I think that the studio system is, and I think that Star Trek being very old is, and I think that when you have a person involved who's largely responsible for it, well, that person can make mistakes. And the ability of that person to make mistakes that then hurt the thing is actually a very important asset. If you lose that by bringing in enough people to keep it going and keep it alive, then you lose the possibility for it to be revolutionary. And that is exactly what happens with everything eventually. And I think it happened with Star Wars a long time ago, and I think it happened with Star Trek a few years ago. Of course, it did happen with Star Trek a couple other times, but I think the really big change was toward the end of Rick Berman's time on Enterprise. When Rick Berman was no longer able to screw things up really hard because other people were covering him, Star Trek became incapable of radical change.
Okay. For me, I've said this before, but whatever it is, J.J. Abrams and I seem to be on the same wavelength when it comes to what it is that makes a movie good. All of his TV shows, all of his movies, pretty much everything that he's done has been stuff where I've been like, wow, you know, like he gets it, you know, in a way that, like, there, you know, a lot of times, like, I'll see something and be like, oh, well, that was interesting, but there was this one little thing where it's like, I don't quite understand why they did that. But with JJ, like, everything that he does, I'm just like constantly impressed by it, you know. Because of that, I'm very much looking forward to anything that he has up his sleeve for the future, but specifically Star Wars, since Star Wars is, you know, one of my favorite things. I'm very excited to see one of my favorite filmmakers tackle that material. So, yes, I'm a huge fan of J.J. Abrams. I love what he did for Star Trek, and I can't wait to see what he's going to do for Star Wars. Well, it's been fun talking about J.J. Abrams today, but that's not all that we're talking about here on Trek FM this week, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
We're on the same page.
Yes.
High five.
This is creepy.
Yeah.
We actually did it,
too.
We actually
tried to do a high five through the camera, so that was embarrassing, but whatever.
Continuing mission.
I feel like this, like, that's a really great idea for a stoner movie. So maybe for the next project, I don't know.
And the name of the film will be Giant Green Lazy Susan.
There you go.
Earl Grey.
VHS Star Trek interactive board game.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
You might have taken over the Enterprise. You now have 30 minutes to stop me.
The Ready Room.
He says, I think your compassion for this species is overriding your judgment. And Archer says, my compassion guides my judgment. Mm-hmm. And I really like that line, because I felt like that really just kind of sums everything up.
The Orb.
So imagine we didn't have Opaka. Imagine we had Kai Winn from the very beginning. How do you think the setup of the series would have been?
Axanar, the official podcast.
So is the full-length Axanar going to be in the same style, the same documentary style as Prelude to Axanar? And the answer is no. No, absolutely not. Axanar itself will be a full-length movie, a feature movie, just like you would, you know, any other Star Trek movie or other movie.
To the journey!
Cable is definitely more suited toward a niche show like Star Trek is.
Compared to broadcast, yes, I think it's...
Yeah, absolutely. It's much more probable that we would see it on, say, AMC than we would on NBC.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
when Star Trek 2009 came out, I made a joke to somebody at some point that J.J. Abrams got all of his lens flares from Close Encounters surplus.
Yeah.
But they just didn't use them all, and he just bought them at some sort of, maybe a garage sale or something.
Warp 5.
You know pretty well which way the insectoids and the reptilians are going to come down on any issue. It's left up to the indecisive one. Instead of the 12 angry men, it's the 6 angry Zindi.
Melodic Treks.
Now, as I mentioned, he wrote and conducted the scores for 2 episodes of Star Trek Enterprise in the 2nd season. They are Kanemar and Regeneration. And Regeneration is one of the best episodes of Star Trek Enterprise ever, in my humble opinion.
Literary Treks.
We're trying to keep it light. We're trying to keep it personable. We're trying to keep it fun. If Vanguard, was all about being the Battlestar Galactica reboot of Star Trek, this is more about trying to be the Eureka or the Warehouse 13.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream from the website. Just visit trek.fm/PD for podcast directory to get all the links. So we have some feedback today. We've got 2 letters from people. The first is from our old friend Crazy Man.
He's so crazy.
The subject is the alternate motion picture. He says, "Hey guys, in your J.J. Abrams episode, your guest," I think he's talking about Matt, "said some rather slanderous things about the towering cinematic masterwork that is Star Trek the Motion Picture. Now, I'm not blaming your guest, as he was merely bringing up popularized myths about the film. I suspect a lot of this slander comes from Harve Bennett, who wants to be seen as the savior of Star Trek, and because he took over for Wrath of Khan, it's an easy narrative for him to sucker people into believing. So let's clear up some things. Number one,
What is the complaint being? What was said?
Well, he's gonna go over.
No, but what was the comment that was made about the motion picture?
He basically said, I think that we were talking about how Star Trek 09 was kind of a reinvention of the franchise in order to bring in a new audience and stuff like that and make it big, and how,
well, I was saying that Star Trek that they're the kind of the same, they kind of have the same job
thing. Yeah, and like Star Trek the Motion Picture did the same thing.
Yeah,
and we had said that the difference was that Star Trek 09 was able to reach a much larger audience and go much more mainstream than the motion picture was. And Crazy Man is saying that's not the case.
Oh.
And here he's saying,
I don't know. Well,
he's going to get into why.
All right.
Number one, the motion picture sold 56 million tickets worldwide. This is still the most attended Star Trek film. J.J. Abrams' Star Trek did not introduce the series to a larger audience than ever before or to a mainstream audience. Trek never attracted. It had. Yeah, but I think there are some lurking variables there, like,
I don't follow the logic.
Home video and stuff.
No, but like, what are the I don't know all the numbers, but like that the motion picture has been seen by more people?
It's they sold more tickets theatrically anyway. But there's home
video.
That's
impressive.
So that's, that's a whole thing too. Number two, adjusted for inflation, the motion picture stands at $456 million, a figure that was only surpassed by Into Darkness as the highest-grossing Star Trek film, and Into Darkness only surpassed it due to 3D ticket prices. It still didn't pass the motion picture in attendance, despite massive new markets like China and Russia. Yeah, but then again, back in 1979, people didn't have VCRs, So
sure. Still, I mean, I'm surprised that 4 wasn't more successful. I always thought that 4 was the most successful of the original cast films.
It was in terms of actual money, but in terms of adjusted dollars, I don't think it was. Maybe motion picture did better than 4, but I don't think so. Anyway, number 3, the motion picture made $140 million worldwide on a $35 million budget. That is 4 times its return of investment. Abrams' film made just over twice their return on investment. Okay.
Is
But I think that, like, Star Trek II did even more than that because it costs so much less.
I wonder, I mean, like, I don't know the grosses for any of these movies.
Yeah.
Because I don't really care.
Yeah.
But, like, I do know that, like, 4 did really well.
Yeah.
And 6 did hardly anything compared to other movies in the series that were much better, which is kind of depressing. But, like, I don't really know the numbers. Mm-hmm. Who knows these numbers? Mm-hmm. Is it possible the crazy man is Rain Man?
You go to boxofficemojo.com.
That seems like a burden. I don't want to do that.
All right. We Trek fans have a lot to be thankful for with regards to the motion picture. If it wasn't for the motion picture, Trek likely would not have lasted as long as it has. They would have made Phase 2, and that would probably have lasted a season or two before it got canceled, and that would have been that. I'm not sure that that's true, but, I mean, there's no way to know. I think that even if they had made Phase 2, Star Wars would have come along, and then they would have said, oh, maybe we should make a movie now.
I think that's... look, it's a butterfly effect, man. Either way... It would be radically different. There's no way to know it would change. But, yeah. Almost everything would change. Who knows, man? Maybe if Phase 2 came out, maybe now there'd be, like, 6 Star Trek series on TV, and one of them would be a cartoon and for kids, and one of them would be a cartoon, and it would be on Cinemax with lots of boobs.
They Who don't knows? Do that on Cinemax anymore.
They don't?
No, now they're legitimate. They make the Nick. I know. It's the end of an era. But what can you do?
I don't really care. That's interesting.
So please, Trek fans of the world, show a little respect for Robert Wise's sci-fi opus. I mean, okay. And actually, we're going to be showing a little respect for Robert Wise's sci-fi opus in a few weeks. We're going to be tackling...
I don't remember seeing anything bad about
Robert Wise. No.
I mean, it's boring.
Yeah. But,
it's certainly smarter than 2009.
He continues...
Strangely enough, it's much worse edited.
Yes.
Which is funny.
He continues, Mike, if you like alternate movie histories, check out the books Tales from Development Hell and The Greatest Sci-Fi Movies Never Made, both by David Hughes. The sci-fi one has an entire chapter devoted to the Star Trek series, including Star Trek Academy film, pitched around the time of The Final Frontier, and the Pillar script, you discussed on your Insurrection commentary. We actually did a whole episode on the Star Trek Academy script from the writer of Lakeview Terrace.
I would also recommend Tales from Development Hell, because when I read that, that was a big deal. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And when I'm talking about how behind the scenes the studio system makes things impossible,
mm-hmm.
I'm referencing from that book.
Yeah.
Because there are things that happen behind the scenes that make a radically reinvented and revolutionary Star Trek impossible, no matter who's involved. Yeah. And the evidence is in books like that, and specifically that book, because I haven't read the sci-fi one.
Yeah. If you go over to Standard Orbit, we did do a Star Trek Academy movie episode where we kind of look at, you know, what that was going to be. And it's kind of interesting, very similar in a lot of ways to Star Trek 09. And the Insurrection commentary, you can find over on commentarytrackstars.com. We'll get into that more in a second, but we, talk a lot about, the stuff that was in the Michael Piller book about the making of Insurrection. So a lot of behind the scenes information about Insurrection on that commentary.
Most of it's pretty sad.
Yeah. He concludes, cheers. Crazy for CTS, man. Get it? Because you were like, oh, he's not crazy. But he is crazy. He's crazy for CTS. Thanks, crazy man. We got another letter this week from Chris from San Antonio. He says, just finished episode 94. I'm not a big fan of Super 8, but it did look like a Spielberg film. Also, thanks for clearing up how Max judges a film, defining like and good helped as well. In the last episode of commentary, Max made reference to Star Trek III and Star Trek V, 3 being bad, 5 as being a good idea but executed poorly, but he would rather hang out with 5. What was so bad about Star Trek III? It is personally one of my favorite original films.
It's professionally one of my least.
Okay. Mike, I listened to your commentary on Star Trek 09, and I agree with your assessment. I tend to break up the Trek films now like I do the Bond films. I think Star Trek 09 is the best of the J.J. Trek films so far. Star Trek 2 is the best of the original films, with Star Trek 6 being a close second. And First Contact is the best of the Next Generation films. Are you planning on doing a commentary for Into Darkness? And last, I think an Alien supplemental commentary would be great for Max to do. I would like to hear his analysis as to how and why it's the perfect sequel or franchise film. Thanks, and keep up the great work. All right, well, thanks, CB. Let's go back and start at the beginning here. Okay, yes, the whole Max defining what's good and what he likes and everything like that, I find that to be really interesting, too. And especially after episodes like this, where Max is, kind of depressed by the state of movies and franchises and everything like that, I think that it would be cool if we started a segment, maybe as a Patreon incentive, to have a thing. Now, I know that you're going to not like this title, but what can I say? Formally, it's best. It rolls off the tongue really nicely. Movies Max likes.
Nope.
Movies Max thinks are good.
Nah.
This is my idea, okay? We have a segment where it's just a few minutes long, but each week, Max, you come with a movie that you think is good. Doesn't have anything to do with Star Trek necessarily, although it could be. You know, maybe it's a Star Trek episode that you think is really good, although I think that a lot of people are on the same page with those. And they could be things that, you know, maybe no one's ever heard of, or things that most people think are terrible.
Whatever. I don't know what you're going with this, but I have tried to figure out how to do this.
Uh-huh.
And I keep coming up against the same problems.
Which is?
Because I can say that there's a difference between things that are good and things that I like. But in order to describe things that are good, I have to define good.
Sure, and maybe we could have like little footnotes where we talk about what your definition of good is.
The whole point of this is that if I'm just sitting here talking, then I'm not going to be able to explain what I'm talking about, because I don't come to movies as a person coming to see a movie. I come with a history of being interested in how movies exist and how storytelling works, and a philosophical groundwork for what meaning is. And like, I'm not kidding when I say I think about Descartes when I'm watching a movie.
And that's fine. And look, this is what I'm saying.
Without explaining that, and I don't know how to do that in a way that fits into any running time.
Well, maybe it can be a challenge for you. I know, look, we've talked about this before. Maybe the thing to do, okay, is not say why you think the movie's good. Just say, this movie is good. I'm going to talk about this movie. And then you can talk about, you know, its use of cheese whiz if you want, you know.
It's much more complicated than that.
Look, this is what we do. This is what we do every week.
Yes.
How hard can it possibly be?
It's astonishingly hard.
Okay.
I have actually attempted to do this on a number of occasions, and the same trap always happens. I start by saying, I'm going to explain this thing, and I'm going to talk about it. And it happens with lots of subjects.
Okay.
And it, like, the most funny my time travel one.
I think you're overthinking this way too much. I think that's absolutely true. You're making this way more complicated than
that is
it
sort
needs
of my
to
thing.
Be. Okay? This is all I'm saying, right? Hey, shit. I've talked to you enough that I know what movies you think are good. I can pick the movie and
but
we
you don't
can
know
talk
why.
About it. No, we don't know why, which is why we have you on the show. Okay? It's not just going to be me saying, this is a movie that Max thinks is good.
Right.
Frack if I know why.
That's the problem.
You know?
I'm not talking about things that I find good. I'm talking about things like what good is. And in order to do that, I can't just talk about what's good.
Well, then maybe we can make a weekly segment where it's like, what Max thinks good is.
No.
Okay, so then, for Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 5, What was so bad about Star Trek III? That's his question.
Star Trek III is in a very sort of abstract sense, largely about the deification of idiocy and the vilification of cleverness and a desire on the part of many people to discount the significance of intelligence.
In other words, you don't like the fact that they took the Genesis device and turned that into a failure instead of an achievement.
It's much more complicated than that.
But to put it into English, you know.
No, because there's a huge amount of stuff, and it all fits together in a very weird way. It's like a web of dumb. There's a whole network of significances that are assembled by Star Trek II, and that network is systematically disassembled by Star Trek III. And it is disassembled like a child with a hammer would disassemble something. It is essentially just smashed to bits.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that it does sort of Alien 3 Star Trek II.
It's so much worse than that.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but I probably would agree with that, but I think that on the whole, the thing that they created is better than Alien 3. But yeah, I mean, there's the whole thing with Spock coming back to life. That's a problem and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely, you know, something where, you know, I never had those problems with Star Trek III because I saw them both for the first time back to back. So I never really had a chance to process Star Trek II as its own thing.
I'll be honest. I don't know when I first saw Star Trek 2 or Star Trek 3. Like, my memories of it are very blurry. But might have seen them back to back. No, probably not. But I couldn't tell you where.
But you thought about Star Trek 2 as its own thing instead of just looking at it as like a whole in the franchise as a piece of the puzzle in the franchise. And I think that. Is an interesting perspective to take, and in doing so, you know, you can see that Star Trek III does kind of quote unquote ruin Star Trek II.
I don't get how that isn't obvious, because I mean, like, the series at this point, like Star Trek the Motion Picture and then Wrath of Khan, radically different things. It's almost as though they're different things, like entirely different properties. It actually feels kind of like one is a sequel to a different show.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be unreasonable for Star Trek II to at the beginning of it say Star Trek the Motion Picture second try.
Yeah,
that would not be a crazy thing to do because so little of motion picture matters for the rest of the movies.
Right.
But the idea that you see 2 and 3 and 4 as being part of some sort of weird bizarre trilogy where Spock dies and then he comes back to life because of a magic planet and then they go back in time to save some whales. I mean, that's an insane trilogy. And
no,
I don't know
I
why people think that that's a trilogy, because it's clearly they just connected up to the ending of the last one because that seemed like the cool thing to do at the time.
Yeah.
And when you get to 5, how is that not part of it? Because it connects up perfectly. There's even the same shot in it. So why is this connected tissue there? Like, why is it that people think of 2 and 3 as connected when obviously they're radically separated?
I can see why people think of 2 and 3 as connected, because 2 ends with Spock dying and then 3 is about him coming back.
Right, but I mean, like the whole scenario, like the whole world changes. Like, it goes from like a movie about people on a spaceship to a movie about people with like magic souls and like a secret mystical cave thing. I mean, it's bizarre. It becomes the freaking Dark Crystal in 20 minutes. You go from a science fiction show with spaceships to magical ghost people and psychic powers. It's crazy. I mean, like, if there was a two-parter of X-Files where one episode had to do with aliens and the other one had to do with some guy coming back to life because of maybe, like, some crystals and some mold, that's the level of absurdity that two-parter has.
Yeah.
I don't know why anybody would ever think of those things as being connected.
Well, I mean, I think because of the obvious reasons. You know, Spock is what it is. But, regardless of that, you know, I never, whether or not they were, it was a two-parter or a sequel or everything, I saw it as, you know, one giant story, like all of Star Trek is one giant story. And, you know, this thing happening and kind of like, you know, sort of like what they did on Deep Space Nine, where they blew up the Defiant knowing that they were going to bring her back in the next episode or whatever, you know, and here, you know, they kill Spock.
No, there was like three episodes, man.
They kill Spock and you know that he's going to be back in the next episode. And because of that, I never really thought of what it was that they did in Star Trek II, or what it was they were trying to do. It seemed more like a comic book death. You know, it was like the death of Superman, where it's like, yeah, well, we already are making plans for him to come back. And while they were, yeah, maybe the people who were actually making Star Trek II weren't making plans for him to come back. And
well, we know that that's true.
That's, yeah, and that's significant. And it really sort of informs your viewing of Star Trek II, or my viewing of Star Trek II now, in a way that it hadn't before. And because of that, you can kind of see a lot of that stuff being diminished in Star Trek III and by Star Trek III. And because of that, I can totally see where you're coming from with Star Trek III. That being said, I enjoy it.
I find it very weird, because to me, Star Trek II is a movie that has like a very particular subtext. And like the idea that at the end of that movie, like they continue the story, but like this whole conceptual subtextual thread is just abandoned.
Sure, but
it's very surprising and shocking to me.
Yes, and if I had seen them for the first time now, I'd probably pick up on that. Seeing them for the first time as a 12-year-old, I think that some of that subtext about, you know, life and death and growing older and everything might have been lost on me. I don't think that I'm alone here. I think that most people look at it the same way that I do, except for maybe people who saw Star Trek II back when it came out.
Honestly, you know, I looked online to try to find some sort of evidence that there are other people who are talking about the same things. And, you know, I didn't do this for years. You know, I'm not tenuto, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't have that kind of like research discipline.
Yeah.
But I haven't found anything yet.
Well, we'll see. Maybe we can talk to John and Larry and see what they were thinking about Star Trek III when it came out.
That would be nice.
So in terms of Max doing a supplemental commentary of Aliens, where he analyzes it and everything like that, I would be all for that. I think that that would be a really cool thing. However, for those people who don't know, we have an Aliens commentary. We have 182 commentaries for movies up on our website, commentarytrackstars.com.
Magical 182.
But we did all the Star Trek movies. We've got a lot of Star Trek episodes on there, and a lot of other movies, too. And we've got a lot of people from Trek FM who have joined us for these various things. We have Drew on to talk to us about Children of Men and Inception and Star Wars. We have Charlene on to talk about the motion picture and Office Space. We've got Colin on to talk about Blade 2 and Star Trek 5. So, you know, there's lots of stuff over there. Just go to commentarytrackstars.com. It's a lot rawer, a lot more argumentative. There's a lot more profanity, and it's a lot less tight because we're talking in real time. So, you know, all of the little things that happen, you know, over the span of 2 hours are just left in. But there's some interesting stuff over there. And I think this week, now what we do now is these off topics where we talk about whatever we want to. And I think this week what we're going to do is we're going to talk about what makes a movie good or not good. So be sure to head over there, Chris, and check it out. What makes a thing good or not good. And there is a commentary that we did on Aliens for you to check out, but I would be all for Max doing another Aliens commentary.
We actually spent most of that talking about our experience with the franchise.
Yeah. So,
how terrifying that tube scene is.
If Max wants to do a supplemental on Aliens, I would be all for that.
I would do that if I felt that we had sufficiently covered the ground of what makes a thing good. That okay. would be lovely. Because
well, we'll see if we can cover.
That's a rabbit hole. Man.
We'll see if we can cover that ground this week on Off Topic. So be sure to go over there and check it out.
This will be an interesting experiment.
All right. Well, before we go, we would like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring commentary Trek Stars to you each week, and our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, including some of the best Star Trek books ever written, like Prime Directive and Federation. There's new titles coming each and every week, classics, current bestsellers, you name it. And Audible has something for everyone, including the adaptation of J.J. Abrams' latest masterpiece, Star Trek Into Darkness, which was written by Alan Dean Foster, narrated by Alice Eve. We talked about this a few weeks ago, but I figured we could talk about it again. Pioneering director J.J. Abrams has delivered an explosive action thriller that takes Star Trek into darkness. When the crew of the Enterprise is called back home, they find an unstoppable force of terror from within their own organization has detonated the fleet and everything it stands for, leaving our world in a state of crisis. With a personal score to settle, Captain Kirk leads a manhunt to a war zone world to capture a one-man weapon of mass destruction.
A war zone world?
Yeah, Kronos.
A war zone world.
Yes.
This is embarrassing.
As our heroes are propelled into an epic chess game of life and death, love will be challenged, friendships will be torn apart, and sacrifices must be made for the only family Kirk has left, his crew.
Oh boy. And what's the auditory version of a lens flare?
And you can get this for free. Since you listen to Commentary Trek Stars, as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you have yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep Commentary, Trek Stars coming to you each and every week, and that's by adopting some aliens.
Well, tribbles?
No, illustrations of aliens. No tribbles.
They got tribbles?
Though. No, they don't.
How come?
I don't know. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find 8 original alien illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork you see on the website. They're available as both badges and art prints, and there are different contribution levels for you to choose from. Just let us know which you would like and in which format. Again, you'll find them at trek.fm/donate, and your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. So that's about it for J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to take a little break from covering people. Because we're going to Dragon Con. Actually, it'll be 2 days after this episode drops. So if you're going to be at Dragon Con on Sunday, hit us up on Twitter at ComTrackStars or email us at gmail.com and let us know. Yep. And we can say hi. And the reason why we're going down to Dragon Con is because this show is a finalist for a Parsec Award for best content creation show. So we're going down there along with Drew from Standard Orbit, who's nominated along with me for Best New Podcasting Team. And yeah, we're going to see what happens. I don't think anything's going to happen, but you never know. Something might happen.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to sweat the whole time.
It is Atlanta.
It's awful.
So yeah, so we're going to be down there, and we're probably going to be recording some stuff along the way. And I think next week we're going to do sort of a two-part series, beginning on our show and continuing on to Standard Orbit, where we look at our trip down to Dragon Con. So that's it for next week. and then we'll get back to other people after that.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you later.
See you.